I'm impressed as I read about Paul that he was able to take a dynamic part in the world without becoming too integrally a part of it. He was a real statesman. He did not shrink from coming to grips with Rome. He did not shrink from entering into the problems of his day with a voice, with a dynamic force. He was first and foremost a Christian in all of his thinking. His great search was for Jesus Christ, not for fame or for world understanding, but for the knowledge of Christ. But as Christ became more and more a dynamic part of his life, he became more and more a dynamic force in the world in which he lived. This is crucial. And one thing that gave Paul a great influence in the world was that he did not get onto the sidetrack of fighting with fellow Christians. He had a message for the world. He went into the world and gave them his message. It's absolutely shattering to the cause of Christ that Christians shouldn't throw rocks at each other. In the world today, we need a strong front. The same thing has been true in our political problems of the moment. It's a shame that men should line up and throw rocks at each other and benefit our enemies thereby. This was a strong point that was made last night in the keynote address to the Republican convention. And it was right. Whatever you think about the Republicans or the Democrats, the point was well taken. Do men think that the office is so important, that they want it so badly, that they're willing to destroy us before our enemies in order to have it? It's a strong point. Should we line up with the communists and fight our own people, our own government, and disparage it in the eyes of the world in order to have some political gain? Same thing is true in the church. Should we fight one another? Should we tear each other apart and vie for position and lose the world while we're doing it? I'm speaking to you tonight as a group of people who want a real understanding of Christianity, who want a practical, solid approach to life in this world today. The things that I say to you would not be accepted by a lot of people because their eyes have been blinded by party spirit within the church. How do we take our place in this world? Not in Paul's time, although we admire Paul, and live as dynamic Christian people doing a job for Christ today and knowing the values and the blessings and benefits that come from such a dynamic relationship to Christ. That's what we want to know. We don't want to know how to promote the Brethren Church or how to promote the Baptists or the Presbyterians. We don't want to know whether this mode of baptism is good or that mode necessarily. We don't want to fight anyone on these issues. We want to know, how does a man take Jesus Christ into his life and live with him and become personally successful as a Christian in this world? Not successful in accumulating things, but successful in living. What attitude do we take? We cannot gather our skirts about us and walk on the other side of the street every time we see the name politics or the name world or any of these things before us. We have to become a dynamic part of this world, but not be tarnished by it. This is the great thing we have to do. In other words, Christ has to be so strong within us that when we stand in the world, we are not beat down by it. This is vastly different than standing off on the sidelines, afraid to engage the world in conflict. But that's what many are doing today as Christians. They have built up a framework of certain petty doctrines and certain cliches of expression, certain religious words that they use and forms of worship and all of these things, and they're over here working around in this framework for their security, and the world goes by, and they never look at it. They wouldn't know what's going on in the world today at all, and they do this under the guise of saying, well, I'm too spiritual for this. I don't want to be worldly. I want to be spiritual, so I won't even think about the world. They wouldn't know whether their representatives of their state are worthy of the office or not. They don't know them. They don't know the issues. I'm not advocating that we go out and crusade for political issues. What I'm saying, as members of this society, we ought to be aware of life around us and not shun it, but get in there and work with men as Christians and take our place in the world as Christians. To this end, I would like to speak for a little bit tonight, and Paul, again, is the, I don't like to say springboard, but let's say that he is the example to us of the things we're talking about. When we see Paul going throughout the world, throughout Asia especially, aware of life as it is, aware of the issues, but taking a Christian stand in the midst of it, striving to know Christ and Christ only as far as his personal relationships are concerned, but nevertheless going out into the world to reach men there. Not with a watered-down expression of the gospel, but a strong, dynamic expression of Jesus Christ. Now, he was not dealing in cliches. He didn't borrow language from his synagogue days or anything like that. He spoke in the language of the people, and he talked about things they were familiar with. He talked to them about the games that they were all attending. He talked to them about boats, ships, and the analogies to life. He talked to them about their agrarian, their agricultural activities and the relationships of those things to Christ. He talked about the Roman government and their relationship to it. How should they be part of this government? What should be their attitude toward the Roman government? Paul said, obey the government. Submit. He didn't say stand off in your little cliques and throw rocks at the government. He said submit because the government was established by God for your sakes, for the sake of the world. He says the government, now listen to, he was talking about a government which in a few days or a few months would burn Christians like torches. He was talking about a government that was already corrupt under the Caesars. But he said of this government, it was ordained by God, obey it. Now that's important. We often forget that when someone will read this and they'll say, well, Paul wasn't in my day when Paul, now this is Romans 13. Let's read that. Let's give you some word on this. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. He says the only powers that exist in this world were ordained of God. Why? We don't know. Why should God let Hitler come into power? We don't know, but he had his reasons. And from Paul's words, had we been members of Hitler's Third Reich, Paul's message would have been as relevant to us as it was to those under Roman tyranny, submit. Now, that doesn't mean we denounce Christ because they want us to. Paul didn't denounce Christ because the Roman government wanted him to. But remember that the government has no voice in the church. Any more than the church has a voice in the government. I cannot go to Washington, D.C. and say, in the name of the church, I demand that you do this. I can go there and say, in the name of as a citizen of the United States, I think this is what we ought to do. But I can't say, as a member of the church, this is what we ought to do. Any more than the government can come into my church and say, the government says this is the way you ought to conduct your church. We have to keep that separation. So when Paul says obey the government, he means obey them in the areas where they have jurisdiction. They do not have jurisdiction over the church. But they do have jurisdiction over the citizenship. And if they say pay taxes, find the money and pay them. If they say you have so much education for your children, this is the education you have. If they want to legislate certain laws that have to do with your life in this world, they have the right to legislate those things. So long as, now in our country, the government technically operates by the consent of the governed. The very nature of our government is such that we can, as a group of citizens of this government, we can come together and decide among ourselves that this government is not fulfilling its responsibility in the interests of the governed and institute proceedings to change it. That's our right under a democracy. It would have been wrong in Paul's day for a group of people to get together and institute proceedings against Rome. They couldn't do it. It would be illegal. It would be anarchical. It is not anarchical for us today as operating under democracy to urge and advocate changing the present structure. So we are not out of line to do this as individuals. I'm not talking about revolution now. I'm not talking about overthrowing the government. I'm talking about the things that Jefferson talked about when he said that when government does not serve the interests of the people, then it is the right and the privilege of the people to alter that government. And it is our right and privilege to speak out. It would not have been correct in Paul's day to speak out against Rome. It would not be correct for a citizen of Russia today to overthrow the Russian government. This is not their place because they have a different form of government over there. And if they are going to be to abide by the laws, insofar as the state is concerned, they must submit. Now, insofar as religion is concerned, they can revolt all they want because the government technically should not have a voice in the church. We have to keep this distinction. I labor it because I want you to see that we have to apply the principle, but we're in different circumstances, you see. So it is the right and privilege of a citizen of these United States as a Christian, to give attention to our citizenship here in this country. We must be subject to it, and if we're going to be subject to it, we are going to have to know something about it. It's wise and right for a Christian to be interested in how his government is run. Let's speak to this a moment. We must recognize, in the first place, that God ordains the power. The man who is put into office in November will, we take by faith, be one whom God allows to be put in. That does not mean that God approves or disapproves of his morals, or of his ethics, or of his governmental abilities, or anything else. He is simply, for this particular situation, he wanted this particular government. Maybe it's in order to drive the world into destruction. That may be. This is no doubt why he has allowed Russia to rise. All right. Now, we assume then that in November, God's man will be put in office, the man he chooses for that office. Now, should I vote? Well, certainly, inasmuch as we are part of this citizenry, and inasmuch as it is representative of good citizenship to vote, yes, vote. But I would not identify my ballot with God's will. I would not be so foolish as to say I know that I have voted the way God wanted me to vote. I'm not sure. I remember elections where I voted for the man that didn't get in, and yet I have prayed for those elections. I was talking to my father-in-law about this one back in 1948. He and I sat up all night together on that one. I've never done it since because what took us 8 hours of agony to find out. We could have gone to sleep and found out in 1 minute the paper the next day, but we were kind of interested in it, so we watched the thing. But we were talking about this, and he said, well, he said, I believe in voting because, he said, I think that I can be guided by the Lord in my voting so that I vote as a Christian. And so I just simply said, well, who did you vote for? And he told me, and I said, well, something went wrong. Now, when I vote on principle. I vote as a Christian ought to vote in principle. I would not vote for a man in office whom I felt was not morally qualified, or whom I felt had a principle that was not morally sound. I can't account for his religion. I mean, I can't say, and I don't want to get an argument at this point, I would have to be very wise in whom I voted for. We might take this issue, for example, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned. There is no question but what the allegiance that a man has to the Catholic Church, whether he wants to admit it or not, has to be a dedicated one. He cannot go against the principles of his church. Or whether you like it or not, this is true. And the history of the Catholic Church has indicated that they are interested in political affairs in a far greater way than the Protestant Church is. And this can't be denied by the Catholic Church either. Now, a man taking his place in public office as a Catholic cannot say, as I can say, that the church and the state do not overlap. I say, as a Protestant, the church and state do not overlap. I am a citizen of the United States on the one hand. I am a member of the body of Christ on the other. I conduct my affairs as a citizenship on the principles of Christianity, but I do not dictate to the state. Now, a man who is a member of the Catholic Church must say that the church has an integral part with the state, and the two are inseparable. And any time a man in public office as a Catholic would go counter to the wishes of his church, he would be denying the very basic principle of his relationship to his church. You see, he can't. Whether he is a free man in a lot of ways, but the idea of raising religious bigotry is not it at all. It isn't a matter of bigotry that I say a Catholic should not be a president. It's a matter of what is the established principle of that church. Now, I have voted for men in times past who do not have a strong religious position, because I don't believe that we are bound to put a Christian into office. We're working in two different areas. We're bound to put a Christian in office in church relationships, you see. We must. But what I am saying is this. It is impossible for a Catholic to separate church and state. No matter how fine a man he is, no matter how much he may wish to be not governed by it, nevertheless, he is. So without condemning the man, without saying anything at this point about the Catholic Church, this is what exists. But in the Protestant Church, there is a separation. We do not believe that the church has control over the government, or should have. Whereas we would like to see Christian men in office, we do not believe it is the place of the church to rule this country. It is the place of a Christian to take a part in affairs where he can be of influence, certainly. But it's not the place of the church to rule this country. One of the great problems in the ministry today, and one of the reasons why I'm not solidly in it, as you know, I mean, I'm not a professional minister, because the minister too often loses touch with the people, because he's always dealing in the realm of these high thoughts and ideas and things, and never gets down where the people are to show them how to live in this world that they're in. He'll show them how to take their place in the church, but he doesn't show them how to take their place in the world as Christian. Now, we can have a tremendous influence in this world for Christ, and we don't have to compromise one principle at all to do it. But we must be relevant. We must meet life where it is. We can't be off here on cloud nine about this whole thing. Paul was cosmopolitan. He was a citizen of the world. We used to think in terms of Wendell Willkie, for example, as in his book One World, as a man identified with the principle of one world. He thought maybe before his time. We know today certain individuals that are really what we would call world citizens because they have expanded themselves to see the issues of the world, not just their own little plot of ground. Now, Paul was such a man. He saw the world and its need, and he went out to meet it. Very realistically a part of that world, but a man with Christian principles to guide him in the world. So that he could talk with the debaters on Mars Hill in Athens. And he could speak to them in a way that they would listen. And he could talk to the people in the marketplace in a way that they would listen. He could talk to them about practical things. He could talk to the philosophers about philosophy. He could talk to government officials about politics, the government. He talked their language. I don't expect, as a Christian, that all of you become proficient in world affairs. That isn't the point at all. You don't have to be. I'm sure the Lord is not intensely interested in what I believe, except from a moral point of view. I mean, I can't be immoral about it. I can't be unethical. But I don't think he particularly worries about the attitude I take toward the platform of the Republican Party insofar as defense expenditures are concerned or insofar as education is concerned. I don't think he cares too much about it. He's not worried about that any more than he cares whether I collect stamps or coins or matchbook covers. This is not part of it. I can do it if I like. And I'm sure he's interested in my life. I don't mean that he is not interested in my life. But he's not going to be directing me as to whether to collect matchbook covers or stamps. Now, I think I can ask him and say, now, what is the Christian attitude about this matter? And he'll tell me. I'm sure he'll do that. But I don't think, if I want to spend some time investigating and working in the field of politics and political science, I don't think it worries him particularly. Unless I were to become so wrapped up in it that I neglected my relationship to the Lord. Let's look at it this way. We're not crusaders for any kind of world government, any government issue. We're not crusaders as members of the church, though I might be as a citizen if I wanted. If you want to go door to door and plug for your candidate, fine, it's all right. But don't do it as a member of the church. Don't say, I'm a Christian, and I think, as a Christian, that we ought to vote for this man or that man. That's out of the question. I think probably the more that you are given to spiritual things, the more everything you do in this life will be, colored, will be affected by your Christian point of view. That's sure. It's certain. That's certainly true. And you will not waste your time going from door to door trying to promote any candidate. But the Lord expects us to have recreation, I'm sure of that. You don't sit and read your Bible 8 hours a day. And I don't disparage reading the Bible. Understand me here. I think it's a good thing. You don't give yourselves 8 hours a day to becoming spiritual. If you do, you fall apart. And I've seen many, many people do this. I was talking yesterday to another person I know about a mutual friend of ours who went into the ministry and I think went out as a missionary or was planning to and had a nervous breakdown and committed suicide. I know why. I know the group that he was with. I know the tendencies of that group. And I can understand why he would commit suicide. I said to Powell that I think sometimes in the seminaries you have the most frustrated group of men you find anywhere because you see they're being pulled apart in every direction. This is why they are so ineffective when they get into your churches. I hope that the things I'm saying tonight are not too confusing to you. I'm trying to make them clear. But look, when you direct all of your thinking toward how you will become spiritual, you're headed for trouble. As sure as the church directs its attention to how it will do this or it will do that, to its internal problems, you see, when it directs its attention inwardly, always, it's got trouble. Just like the person who has nothing to do but sit around the house all day and examine their symptoms. They become what we call hypochondriacs. They become psychologically ill. They're always ill. And they're just as a constant stream into the doctor's offices today of people who, and this is no criticism of women, but who have perhaps a house to take care of. If there are no children, they may have nothing else to do but sit around the house and with a few licks here and there. And without children, it's not too big a problem to take care of a house, I imagine. But a good part of their time, they can sit around and try to figure out what new symptoms they have, what new illnesses and diseases. So they're in a steady stream to the doctor's office. The higher up you go on the income bracket, the more true this is, because then everything is done for them, and all they have to do is think about themselves. And it becomes like a cancer inside and eats away. Anytime you direct your attention onto yourself, it's going to start eating out the inside. The church has torn itself apart because it's always looking in to see what it's doing inside. If they will quit looking at each other and look out to those that have need, they'll get healthy all of a sudden. They'll lose this hypochondriac situation. I saw a cartoon the other day. Well, I think it was in one of the Brethren productions. I happened to get a copy of it the other day. It was trying to portray the lethargy of the church and failed in some respects, but there was one very important item. The man is lying on a hammock. Here's all the people in trouble out in the world. He's lying on his hammock, you see, snoozing. And beside him on his table is the traditional glass of lemonade, which they always had. The glass is marked revival movements or meetings, revival meetings. This is their little cure-all. They're going to have a revival meeting. There's a problem, so they're going to have a revival meeting. They'd have all the revival of their soul they would need if they would begin looking out for the world and its needs. Begin looking at their country and its needs. Begin asking themselves, how do I take my place as a citizen of my community and wield an influence for the Lord in this community? I don't mean you go out and join the clubs and all of this. Not at all. But you become aware of what life is around you. And you ask yourself and you ask the Lord, how can I best fit into the world picture? Now you begin to get healthy. You get your mind. Forget about yourself. You can't do anything to make yourself spiritual anyway. Forget it. You're a child of the Lord, fine. Sign your name and let's go on, you see. I'm not advocating here simple decisions. I hope you realize that. But settle the thing once and for all. All right, you're a child of the Lord. He has the job of fixing you up. He has the job of disciplining you and training you and helping you. Fine, leave it with him. Then take your place in your community and in your world as a dynamic representative of Christ. Now, by dynamic representative of Christ, I don't mean that you go around buttonholing everybody and trying to persuade them to be what you are. But whatever you do and whatever you say, whatever attitudes you take in this world ought to reflect Christian principles within, ought to reflect the love of Christ, ought to reflect the family name you bear, which is Christian. When my children go out into school and into the homes of their friends, I want them to act as becomes a Morsi. I've tried to train them how to act. Our name has a certain significance to us because we have tried to... Now, I don't mean that there's anything important about it, but I mean that we've always tried to keep it clean. We don't have a police record on it or anything like that. We've tried to keep it clean. I don't mean that I would disown my boy if he ever got a police record because I'd try to help him. But so far we've kept it pretty well clean. Now, I like my children to take their place in the community in a way that is worthy or that properly reflects this. And Christ wants you to take your place in the community as becomes a Christian. Not squabbling over the back fence with your neighbors. Not rushing around crusading on this little thing and that little thing. But calmly and sturdily facing life and expressing your help and graciousness to your neighbors and friends that are in need. Here again in our giving, we're off the track in so much of this. You see, as a church, we've all settled into the matter of giving to build some structure, either ideologically or physically. What do our gifts to the church do? They build a framework of some kind. We don't know what. Paul was urged to remember the needy, the poor. This money would be far better used to help the poor and needy in our churches and among our Christian friends and some who are not Christians who just need help than it is to build great big structures. Money is poured down the drain in setting up little organizations, offshoot organizations, you know, that are going to do this and that and the other thing. And the money pours in. They all have to have a separate secretary and a separate office, and you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars a month hiring secretaries and renting offices and making signs for these offices and printing up letterheads and everything so that these little deals can go along. Now, we're just building structures. The world has always been influenced. One Martin Luther can turn the tide of Europe. One Billy Graham, whatever your attitude toward his methods are, one Billy Graham can do a tremendous amount of work. And throughout the history of the world, when God has gotten hold of men, they have operated on a minimum of expense as far as capital is concerned. Now, in this respect, for all, again, that you may not approve of all the methods of the rescue missions, they have a principle. They have a point here. There's no use to talk to a man about his soul as long as he's being driven nuts by hunger pains, you know. As long as he sleeps out in the rain at night, you can't bring him in now and say, forget about all of this, brother. Come to Christ. But you fill his stomach up and give him a place to sleep. Then you can talk to him about the Lord. Then he's going to listen. And the Lord lashed out against this in such strong words when he says, He's talking about the difference between Christians and non-Christians. He calls them sheep and goats. He calls the Christians sheep and the non-Christians goats. I said, there's coming a day when the sheep will be separated from the goats. And what is the basis of their separation? To the sheep, he says, come up here with me into everlasting life because when I was in prison, you visited me. When I was sick, you ministered to me. When I was in need, you gave me help. And so forth. And they said to him, these sheep, these Christians said, Lord, when did we see you in prison and visited you? When did we see you in need of a place to sleep and gave you that place? When did we see you thirsty and gave you drink? And he said, inasmuch as you did not do it unto one of the least of these, you did not do it unto me. Now, we've become so interested in building our little spiritual ideologies and our little church frameworks that we've utterly forgotten the world. In this strong, vibrant sense, we'll send a delegation here and there, yes, but I mean in the strong, vital sense that we take our place in our community as a Christian, see the needs of it, and help wherever we can. And we are not above giving a poor fellow who needs a cup of coffee, whether he ever accepts the Lord or not. Now, we should be careful. I know in certain areas you have to be careful that you don't send a man to get drunk by giving him money. And I've often had to be careful about this.